programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by Plant Mode in downtown Champaign. Since 2013, Plant Mode has been providing the 217 Plant Gang with tropical and succulent plants, planters, artwork, vinyl records, and local-made woodworked items like plant stands, benches, cutting boards, and rolling pins. Plant Mode now at 520 North Neal Street, right across from the post office. Updates daily on Instagram and on plantmode.com.
Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois, and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, April 20th, and this is episode 11 of The Rift. Now, the format of this show is usually focused on a specific topic within the realm of the planetary ecological crisis. You know, I've been very fortunate to have wonderful guests who are experts on electric utilities or fossil fuel propaganda or the environmental history of Palestine and many other important issues that I've felt are very much worth learning about. And as always, if you'd like to go back and listen to those episodes or any other episode of the show, you can search for The Rift on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcast aggregator of your choosing, or go to linktree.com/theriftradio. But even as we attend to the particularities of various eco-political struggles, it's also important to consider the bigger picture, to think about the movements that we'll need to build and the strategies that we'll need to employ in order to even have a chance at preventing the worst outcomes of climate change and ecological breakdown at a global scale. That's the subject of the book, What's Left? Three Paths Through the Planetary Crisis, by author, activist, and Marxist intellectual Malcolm Harris. After the break, you'll hear my conversation with Malcolm about the book, his interpretation of the current political landscape for the left-wing climate and environmental movements, and what paths forward we might consider. But first, programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by SunPower by Legacy Solar, based in Towanda, Illinois. A proud supporter of WEFT, SunPower by Legacy Solar provides services throughout the state of Illinois, specializing in residential and commercial solar panel installations. Learn more at legacysolarpower.com or by following their Facebook page, SunPower by Legacy Solar. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you in part by The Canopy Club, hosting live music and events, including The Piano Man every Monday night. The Canopy Club has welcomed national and regional artists, rock, indie, hip-hop, electronic, and all genres, for over 25 years. Find information on upcoming events at canopyclub.com or by following The Canopy Club on all social media platforms. And with that, here's my conversation with Malcolm Harris, author of the new book, What's Left? Three Paths Through the Planetary Crisis. I'm joined now by Malcolm Harris, author of the new book, What's Left? Three Paths Through the Planetary Crisis. Malcolm, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to talking about it.
So in your last book before this one, Palo Alto, A History of California, Capitalism, and the World, you kind of explored the hyper-capitalist past and present of Silicon Valley. And to someone like me, who many years ago worked in tech and then left to become a bad approximation of a Marxist geographer, it actually seems pretty natural that after dipping your toes into that world, you'd turn your attention to the planetary ecological crisis. But I'm curious if you could talk about what drove you to write this new book.
It's going to sound like a joke, but it came to me in a dream, is the actual story. No, I had a whole other book proposal prepared. I had like a call with my agent to pitch a whole different book, actually about human capital, which follows directly from the previous book and the research for that. And the night before I was going to have that conversation, I had a dream, and I don't even remember what the dream was, but I awoke with this phrase on my lips of oil is life. And I felt like it was a sort of key phrase for understanding the reality of the climate crisis and our inability to deal with the climate crisis, and sort of a different perspective on the situation than I've had, than I've seen described in other book projects. And so I very quickly like put together a proposal for this like oil is life project, and pitched that instead. And my agent liked it, and my publisher liked it, and here we are. But it was not something that I was like, oh, I need to write a climate book because climate's a hot issue right now, or like even something that I was like, oh, I'm like driven by long-term passion on this topic and need to find a container for it. It was like this way of approaching what seems to me, you know, obviously a centrally important issue for our situation, thrust itself upon me, and I had to do something with it. And that's what the book is. And then I decided to not write the book as I planned to write it, which was like why I'm right and everyone else is wrong about the climate crisis, and how like only Marxism can solve our problems, which, I, you know, to a certain degree, I still believe. But rhetorically and analytically, it left a little to be desired in terms of my outline. And so I ended up writing a different project that really looked at a series of strategies, progressive strategies that I see as viable or potentially viable for getting us through this crisis.
Right. So yeah, I was going to ask, you spend the meat of the book kind of laying out these three strategies for the left in navigating and fighting climate and ecological crisis, which you call market craft, public power, and communism respectively. Could you just briefly lay those out for me and how you sort of arrived at that kind of taxonomy?
Yeah, and it started with this phrase, oil is life, and the medium term that I add in there is value, which is that oil is life because it's valuable. It's not because we actually consume a lot of fossil fuels directly in our households, which as Americans, those of us who are Americans, don't. We don't actually consume a lot of fossil fuels directly. It's mostly indirectly through our lives and through our employment. And value is the term that mediates our reliance on fossil fuels. And so once you have this sort of, you know, syllogism, you have the oil value life chain, which is how I describe it in the book, then you can think about analytically different ways to approach breaking it or getting past it. I think of it as like wrapped around a gate, and we have to get through the gate, and there's a chain that is holding the gate shut, and this is the character of the chain. I sometimes use like really extended metaphors, but I find them valuable for thinking through these questions. And this chain wrapped around the gate to the future is a really useful one for me. And the three strategies that I lay out in the book, which go from like you said, market craft, public power, and communism, which I think is basically the entire left spectrum, from the like far left liberal all the way to a communist like myself. And they all three of those strategies, as I lay them out, have different approaches to handling this locked gate problem, different approaches to this oil value life chain. And so market craft, the goal of market craft is to use market and regulatory techniques to push the value of fossil fuels beyond down below their cost of extraction, basically to make fossil fuels worthless using government and economic policy in order to finagle that situation. Because right now, fossil fuels are, in fact, extremely valuable, and it's hard to think of them as not valuable. But in a situation where we have like abundant green energy, it's hard to justify extracting fossil fuels, never mind burning them. That's the market craft strategy. The public power strategy says, yeah, we can do some of that, some of the market craft stuff, but we also need to accomplish the things that we need to accomplish directly under the auspices of the state. So you hear sometimes described as the like big green state solution. It's saying like, you know, if we need long-term energy storage facilities, we're not going to like create market conditions that will create the, you know, incentives for market actors to build the kind of storage we need. It says, we'll just do it. We'll figure out the auspices under which we'll do it, but we'll do it in the name of the public, by the public. And so that's the public power solution. And the vehicle for that political change is the organized labor movement. So the idea is that the organized labor movement self-develops on behalf of society as a whole, takes hold of the productive machinery, and completes this green transition directly rather than relying on market agents. So that's the second strategy. And the third strategy, which I describe as communism, is breaking this connection between value and life to say we're no longer going to arrange life on this planet around this question of your relation to value, and every person will no longer be required to make themselves valuable in economic terms. Instead, we'll organize ourselves around, you know, to each according to their needs, from each according to their abilities, which is the classic Marxist algorithm for how we should produce and consume and distribute needed resources and goods and time. Such a situation, such a determination about how we're going to organize ourselves will allow us to stop burning fossil fuels, because one of our needs is not to have the temperature increase by 4 degrees.
Got it. Yeah. So returning to this formulation of oil is value and value is life, which, you know, reading the book, I thought it was both pretty elegant and also, you know, a couple of weeks ago, actually, the very last episode of the show that I did was about the Dakota Access Pipeline fight, which, of course, one of the main slogans of the indigenous resistance that was popularized during that fight was water is life. Mm-hmm. And it sort of struck me that that's almost a direct refutation of that value chain.
And yet we have, you know, we agree, and we agree with this. Everyone knows that water is life. It's the reason that it's been such a important slogan is that it's so obviously true, right? Like we know that there is no life, certainly not for humans, without clean water and a water cycle that works, which means not like polluted by fossil fuels. And yet that hasn't led, like the acknowledgement of that truth has not led to vast social changes. It hasn't led to the changes necessary in order to like logically react to it, right? And so there has to be something even truer than that, is sort of my understanding. It's like it seems hard to imagine that there could be something truer than like humans need water. Humans need clean water to live. But there is, right? We know it, because we're destroying our clean water in order to maintain access to fossil fuels. So fossil fuels, logically, right, must be more crucial to our life as it exists than clean water, or else we'd be behaving differently. And I think acknowledging that and dealing with that reality is a really important first step for any sort of actual solution at the scale of the problem. Because if our solutions can't deal with that fact, then it's going to keep being the determining fact. And I think about it like the war on drugs, that like every nation in the world is allegedly been fighting a war on drugs for decades, and like drugs have won, period. Like every step of the way, drugs win. Drugs beat every country in the world. You know, every country is aligned in the war against drugs. Drugs win every time. And if we had a war against fossil fuels under capitalist conditions, the same thing would happen, right? We could have a global war on fossil fuels where every country is devoted to stopping the extraction and burning of fossil fuels, which is far away from where we are, right? We'd think that would be like a huge advance, but there would still be illicit networks of fossil fuel like smuggling and burning, and there would be rogue states where they could find themselves, find their situation improved by disobeying sort of the global consensus on these things, just like we see with the war on drugs. Transnational criminal organizations profiting from fossil fuels, like all of this would happen. And that's if the situation was way better than it is right now, right? That's if we actually united the global political system against fossil fuels, even ostensibly. So I think we really got to get to this core question.
Yeah, it's almost describing things as they are rather than as they should be. And, you know, germane to that point, I think some of the most resonant writing in the early parts of the book to me was about this project of treating consumption and production of fossil fuels as distinct rather than deeply interrelated. And, you know, as someone who has been a practitioner in the mainstream climate policy world, regrettably, you see that a lot in the form of the conversations about distinct supply side and demand side policy approaches, carrots and sticks, so to speak. And the idea that we can have one without the other. I mean, I think that most people will admit that what we have now, for the moment, with the Inflation Reduction Act, is more or less a carrots-only approach. What do you think that that way of thinking kind of obscures? I think you touched on it with this thought exercise about how states would respond to that, even if there was political will behind it.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that capital is an impersonal system. And we sort of treat it as a puzzle that like has a solution out there. But there's a reason that it keeps evading these challenges to the way it operates. And that's because we experience its injunctions at this really like, we experience the injunctions personally, but no one has to be like out there assigning them personally. And that's different than the system that we're trying to replace it with, right? If we're like trying to plan a social metabolism that's not reliant on the extraction and burning fossil fuels, we have to do it very, very intentionally. We have to think about like what people need and how we can provide it and what the consequences of those actions would be. Whereas in capitalism, you don't really have to do that. You just like issue wants and the market like it shifts in order to meet those wants. And that's a real thing that happens. And that's a very powerful system. But it really puts us at a disadvantage in terms of trying to impose social planning on a system that is like built to evade it. That's like main characteristic is that it evades any attempt to control it. And people who are pro-capitalist think of it, this is like its main virtue or whatever. That no one can control capitalism, that it exists outside of any, you know, personal manipulation or whatever. But we're experiencing as a species is that that's a real problem, and that it prevents us from looking at things holistically, like you were saying, that we end up separating production from reproduction, from circulation, from waste, from maintenance, from all these other questions that like are just as important, at least is just as important, and might even be more important for some of these questions than production. But because our system is based on the production of value and it's a mode of production, it sees itself that way. And we end up seeing the world the way it sees the world. And we think about all these other problems as like distinct and something that we can tweak within the system. But it's not the case. Obviously, like production and circulation and waste and maintenance and reproduction are all implicated in this like larger metabolic process. And so just focusing on this question of production is never going to solve the problem for us. And that same with consumption, right? If we just focus on consumption and production, we still won't be able to solve the problem because there are actually other kinds of variables for social metabolic interactions. There is maintenance, there is waste, there is reproduction, that are very, very important. And we start using those as like sinks for costs in the production system. So if we don't think about like reproduction consciously, we could create a system in which we're using the reproductive systems of all the animals on the planet as sort of a sink for our costs of production. And Naomi Klein writes about this like really well, I think, actually, This Changes Everything, I think is the title of that one, where she talks about like the reproductive systems of like the entire animal kingdom being totally wrecked by our current production system, and all including humans, that we've seen like huge all sorts of like reproductive issues with people. And but yet the way capitalism views the world, we have a trouble integrating that with our understanding of production, that these things are related to each other and that if we need to think about them holistically.
So returning to this sort of tripartite formulation that you introduced in the book, one of your primary criticisms of market craft is that it kind of overlooks or even precludes the idea of internationalism and broadly speaking operates on a country by country basis. Particularly from our view here in the West. I think thus far in countering this, a lot of global climate justice activists talk about historical responsibility for climate change, you know, in essence, what wealthy nations of the global North through colonialism and imperialism and appropriation of resources have accumulated this immense debt of carbon emissions and thus owe it to the rest of the world to be quickest to decarbonize. And, you know, personally, I think that even that framework, though, you know, much improved, doesn't necessarily capture the entirety of the way that the global economy functions today, in which you see global North financial institutions attempting to acquire and privatize the infrastructure of transition of clean energy. Mm-hmm. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Brian Kamanzi, a researcher from South Africa who is really focused on the grid there. And, you know, we were talking about how this happens to the extent that things like renewable energy can almost seem like a Western imposition of privatization. Absolutely. In other parts of the world. So I'm kind of wondering where you feel like some of these ideas around climate reparations or tech transfers or things to resolve that quandary can kind of fit into what you've proposed.
Yeah, you'd think, right? So the model I have for internationalist market craft, because you're right, market craft, and as I write, is market craft is a really national perspective, right? That's how we arrange markets and economic policy under the status quo. Mostly, you know, you have international agreements and trade blocks and stuff like that. But ultimately, even with a block like the EU, ultimately these countries are, as we're seeing when push comes to shove, thinking about these questions in national terms. About the national economy and national jobs and like national borders.
I mean, we've split our, you know, emissions goals into, you know, nation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Commitments.
Well, and our policy as well. So you look at like what's the most important United States climate policy ever passed or whatever, and it's giving people $7,500 not to buy Chinese electric vehicles, right? Like that's the thing. It's not even like to buy electric vehicles. It's to not buy an electric vehicle from China, which would give it, we would sell it to you 10 grand cheaper or whatever. And now we're seeing that shift towards tariffs as opposed to subsidies for domestic producers or in addition to subsidies for domestic producers or whatever. But that's not a very like good global climate policy, right? Like we should be trying to build out as much as we can and spread it internationally. And even, I mean, I've been surprised how little that's been part of China's international strategy. There's been a little bit like in Cuba, there's recently been some Chinese project to help support a grid there. But it's like, don't they have a lot of extra solar panels? Like, couldn't they just like do that like very quickly as a model for what that kind of work could look like? Rather than letting the Cuban people suffer from lack of energy because of the role that they've played historically in opening up the space for the Chinese people to maintain their sovereignty to build these systems in the first place. Like if we're talking about debts, right? Like the carbon debt isn't the only kind of debts internationally that we have. So I've been saddened to see the Cuban people go unpaid for their profound debts, not just in terms of not producing carbon at the same rate as other people, but of even giving humanity a chance to have any sort of control at this point historically. We all owe the Cuban people a lot. The people of the world owe the Cuban people a lot. And so if anyone's lining up for tech transfers or subsidies, I think they should be first in line, both because they're suffering from real deprivation, real lack. Like, we can see what happens when we don't have all the pieces in line. And at the same time, they are owed, and it's a real opportunity, and they have like the technical skills in order to put these things in place. And we should end the blockade and allow the Cuban people to lead humanity once again. So that's what I would love to see, right, in terms of tech transfers. And the model I use for internationalist market craft, because it is possible, right? We have models in the past of internationalist market craft. And the best one is probably the Montreal Protocol, which is what ended the use of chlorofluorocarbons. And that the way that was done is very interesting, where you had like committees of scientists that were issuing global permits to different industries to use these chemicals for certain periods of time, and then revoking them once these groups of scientists have said, oh no, you've got a good enough substitute, asthma inhaler industry, you can't use chlorofluorocarbons anymore. You used to be able to, because obviously we need the inhalers to keep working, but now we've got this other solution, so you all have to move to that other solution. And we could imagine something similar with fossil fuels and, like, you know, the airplane industry or whatever. You know, there are lots of industries that were going to have to be decarbonized over time. And we could imagine an international committee of scientists whose job it was to figure out decarbonizing global industry one by one. But that's not going to happen. And that took a lot of exceptional United States leadership to get the Montreal Protocol, which was able to happen because we banned CFCs first here. And I don't think the U.S. is going to show that kind of leadership when it comes to fossil fuels. At very least, we haven't.
So moving on to your discussion of public power, you wrote about how the quality of public electric infrastructure is intrinsically tied to other public goods, high quality public education, housing, healthcare. And that's something that becomes really apparent, for example, when you look at the housing stock in the United States and how poor insulation and improper installation of heat pumps can really negate any benefits of clean energy, especially for low-income people living in low-quality housing, and how organized landlords can even sabotage some of this stuff. So when it comes to these entangled webs of power that span really broad landscapes across these different issues, how do you necessarily think about order of operations, so to speak, for movements? Where do people look first?
Yeah, and that's one of the tricky questions that I talk about, I think, in all of the sections, because people are going to be acting in all of these strategies and continue acting through all of these strategies the whole time. I don't think of it as like a stages thing. People have asked me if I thought about it that way and suggested that it's maybe set up that way. But I don't think any of the partisans are mostly not thinking about it that way, of the different strategies, and I don't think about it that way. I don't think the market craft people are like, first we do market craft, and then we do public power, and then we'll do communism, even though that is like the sequence of the book. So order of operations is going to be different for each of the strategies, even though it's market craft seems like more apparent because we still live under a global capitalist system now. And so it seems like maybe you do market craft first and then public power. But I think there are actions that everyone can take in their different strategies and are taking right now. So I don't think we have to like wait for one and then the other, if that's what you mean.
I guess I wasn't necessarily asking about the order of operations of these strategies so much as being able to tackle things like housing quality or healthcare or education.
Absolutely. Sure. And so like, what's the point of putting a heat pump in a house with broken windows, right? Like it's doesn't make a lot of sense. And yet we're going to do that, right? Like it's already being done, and we're going to do it. And so I don't think if we're waiting to do everything in the right order, then we're not going to do it. Right. So obviously we want to minimize these like stupid mistakes that we're making, which I think has to do with like thinking a lot about what we're actually doing and not hoping that some policy will solve everything, and being able to really like think with contradiction, because I don't think there's a like solution, right? And I feel like some of the policy agendas or political agendas on the progressive side are looking for an all-purpose answer without any like contradictions in it, right? It's like just build more houses, just build more whatever, build more factories. And that might be part of the answer, right? Like, I do think we need to build more houses and be like really thoughtful about the kind of houses we're building and where we're building them and the condition of those houses. So I think just build is just do anything. I find that it's pretty alarming, the suggestion that we need to think less about our issues. And I get like when people are complaining about like, environmental impact reports are stopping clean energy infrastructure and we need to build it faster. So we need to stop doing environmental impact reports. I get sort of the first part, but the second part doesn't follow for me at all. It seems like, well, then we need like a lot more resources doing environmental impact reports faster, because in terms of thinking about how the actions we're taking now are going to impact the environment in the near future and in the later future, that seems like one of the most important things we need to do with our social resources in the world, period. Like, we need tons and tons and tons more jobs doing environmental impact reports and like thinking through what we're actually doing and our policies and our actions at like, you know, really micro levels, because the environment doesn't exist in one way throughout the whole world, throughout the whole country, throughout whole states, throughout whole cities, right? We have like all sorts of shifting conditions that we need to have real granular understandings of. And I find the impulse towards just like, oh, just increase the level of abstraction. Like, don't worry about that so much. Like, no, we really need to worry about all of these things at the same time. And so unfortunately, we do. There's not an answer that is free from contradictions. And it doesn't mean that we're not going to switch out the induction, you know, stoves for induction or whatever, or put in the heat pumps in some places where we haven't thought through the whole situation yet. Like, that's going to happen. We are making those mistakes. We're going to keep continuing to make those mistakes. But we need to try to do it less and really like think through what we're actually doing in terms of these policies and in terms of the way that these strategies work, not just the individual policies, but the larger strategies and the way that they contradict each other or work together, can cohere in important ways. And there's no like easy way through or out of this like set of contradictions, which is why we have to work with them. And that's a lot of what I spend this book trying to do. And every section, I've been very even-handed, I think, about the three sections structurally. So every strategy gets five sections about why it's a good strategy and its strengths, and then three sections about its vulnerabilities and its like holes or whatever. I'm not trying to find the key or the next action that everyone has to take. The question is what we're doing and how we relate to each other and how it works. I don't think there is some like solution that no one has thought of and that, you know, you just need to listen to me.
No one weird trick.
No, there isn't. And I find the people who are saying the weird trick is to like, again, think less, study less, act more, pretty alarming. Because like we don't have a really good handle on what we're doing as a society right now, or in the conditions under which we're doing it, and I think that's showing up now in the Trump administration for sure, where you have something like these tariffs as we're talking that no one, it's not even that people don't know it's a bad idea. People do know it's a bad idea. They just don't know what the right idea is, and so they have a hard time like figuring out exactly what the angle is to critique this policy because they haven't thought through this stuff through.
Yeah. So this conversation about, renewable energy permitting, it kind of brings us to what I think is one of the thorniest problems in all of ecological planning. And it's this question of of what I think of as managing scales of democracy, weighing local versus regional, national, or global benefits and risks, and how to take people's needs into account accordingly. And so one example that you use to illustrate this in the book is the Kauai Utility Cooperative in Hawaii and their plan to build out some renewable energy, which was actually opposed by local residents on the grounds of a violation of cultural sites. And it made me think of Thea Rio Franco's book, Resource mm-hmm. Radicals, which details similar conflicts between Rafael Correa's desire to use mineral extraction to fund Ecuador's welfare state, which he did, and the indigenous peoples who actually live near the mining sites and suffered the effects of mining. And I was wondering, I guess, how you imagine the three paths that you've laid out might interact at these scales, particularly given that, you know, being realistic, there is an existing power differential between a market craft strategy, which we already employ to some extent, versus a public power which might have a green state behind it, versus communism, which certainly doesn't.
Yeah, I think the Kauai example is a really good one, actually. And it's an interesting one because it resolved while I was writing. So the project in Kauai, which has one of the most advanced renewable grids in the country for sure. It's like almost full on sunny days, it's fully renewable. And there are a lot of sunny days in Kauai, right? Like it's like very, it's an island in Hawaii, obviously. But one of the issues you have is storage, right? It's long-term energy storage is difficult. And as people may or may not know, if you've read this book, you know, the by far dominant mode of grid scale energy storage is this thing called pump storage hydro, which is where you pump water from one reservoir to another it's higher raised, and then it stores energy in this higher reservoir, which flows down over a turbine, releasing the power that had been stored up. And like it's over 90%, both in the United States and globally, of long-term energy storage grid scale is through pump storage hydro. And West Kauai is one of the few projects in the United States that's been moving forward because of our really poorly designed utility and energy system has made it hard to build these pump storage hydro facilities. And we haven't built one in the 21st century. But this one's very advanced. But the issue was that there were water protectors and land protectors organized on Kauai who said, look, this plan where you're going to use the irrigation, the colonial era irrigation system, reuse it for this pump storage hydro plan to push water through these old irrigation systems is messed up. And here's why. And they had a bunch of reasons why. It's like, one, it's going to waste fresh water, which we have really, really limited amounts of on Kauai, because we don't have the farming infrastructure ready in these places to take that water back. You're going to bring pesticides that had lodged in the soil through the water system by re-engaging these this colonial era gitches, and you're going to like prevent the healing of this river ecosystem in the first place. And so it was they were saying like, we're not opposed to a pump storage hydro facility in Kauai. We're not opposed to clean energy. We're not opposed to energy. We're opposed to this plan to use these irrigation ditches in this way because we know a lot more about it than you do. And the they blocked the project in a way that I think that some people are really opposed to, using these kind of environmental concerns to block clean energy projects. They find this really like alarming, but they did. And they used their leverage to block the project and ultimately came to a resolution to build the project, but to build it as a closed loop project, one that's where the water's not flowing through these old irrigation ditches. And so it's a reduced in scale somewhat, but they were able to come to an agreement and move forward with the project. And like, that's not crazy, right? Like that's not impossible. In fact, those are the kind of things that we're going to have to figure out how to do over and over and over and over and over again. We're gonna have to figure that out a lot. And we should think about that as like a real victory, right? To incorporate the knowledge of people who have like the really absolutely granular knowledge about the particular places with the like grid scale planning for an energy system that everyone acknowledges that we need. Those aren't, like, if those are in conflict, that doesn't mean that the conflict can't be resolved, that we can't find a solution in there. And I find it alarming when some people are like, we need to make things work in general. We can't worry about the particularities, right? And they like contrast the local versus the like national or the global or something. It's like, but the national and the global are made up of localities. Like you can't destroy the world in all its particularities in order to save it in general. That doesn't work like conceptually. It doesn't work ecologically, right? Because these are like overlapping, densely overlapping, really particular ecological systems that make the larger system. And you can't just like pick and choose, you know, oh, if we invent enough robot bees, then we'll just like get to play the environment like it's SimCity. It's like, I'm sorry to tell you, but like SimCity is not real. Like that's not what actually planning social metabolism for a species like humanity is like. That's not what the world is. And like, you can't really play SimCity in the real world. It's not like that. You need to rely on the actual particular knowledge of communities that maintain relations to particular pieces of land. And in places like much of the United States, where those communities have been uprooted and destroyed and subject to genocide, we're going to have to recover that kind of knowledge, because without the knowledge of particular places, we're not going to be able to plan in general. We just won't be able to do it. We're going to do it wrong and we're going to fail.
So ultimately, you argue, as you have thus far, that the three strategies that you outline are all worthwhile to some extent, and that the left will need a diversity of tactics to succeed. And you spend some time finding points of unity between these three paths, essentially ways that they can complement each other. And I think that that's valuable thinking. But I'm also curious about what you think of the fact that thus far, we very often see the opposite, you know, points of rupture, where adherents of one strategy are put in positions that they find untenable by adherents of another. What I immediately think of is the, you know, very unstable coalition that helped pass the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, organized labor, environmental justice groups, clean energy groups, that sort of moment of unity that allowed for its passage was over basically as soon as it began. You know, you saw almost immediate ruptures between environmental justice groups and unions on some of the alternative fuel things like hydrogen and carbon capture. And, you know, I wouldn't neatly group environmental justice advocates into you know, public power or communist formations, but the outcome was that their policy proposals that landed closer to those categories were pretty systematically marginalized by, you know, market-craft adherents within the Biden administration. And it caused a good deal of bad blood and disorganization, and I think you're kind of seeing that come home to roost now. So I was wondering what thoughts you had on that and what you think the path to building unity between these strategies is when they so often come into conflict. And you know, I know you just talked about an example of really generative conflict, and I think there's something to that. But there are other times when when it's pretty destructive.
Yeah, I mean, I think unity is a really high bar, right? I think like getting everyone in this field to subject themselves to the same like rules, to the same group discipline, is like probably not going to happen most of the time. Sometimes maybe, you know, in certain situations, I would like to see a like anti-fascist moment where we could all pull together in the anti-fascist organizing, for example. And that did happen a little bit under the first Trump administration, I think. I think we saw some real coalition action of that type. But I think coherence is a lower bar, and one that maybe we can clear easier, which is we need to like know what each other is working on and understand it and figure out how we relate to it. Not just like, not necessarily adversarially or not necessarily participatorily, but we really need to understand what everyone's doing. And I think there's a resistance to that within more of the mainstream, that they don't really have to understand the other arguments because they are empowered by their position within at least especially within the American moment by their access to power, and that the left has to just fall behind the center left in this country. And I think we've seen how that doesn't work, how that has failed to work, and doesn't provide a like coherent governing coalition or even a like majority or enough people to get things done. And we've seen the like really catastrophic failure, I think, by the Biden administration and by their supporters, especially around the genocide in Gaza, that's their failure to adhere to the basic points of unity. And I think we would be in a different place if they had been able to do that. And so I put a lot of that specific failure at their doorstep, because that was a choice. That was a very specific choice, and it was a wrong choice. As wrong as you get, as just like wrong top to bottom. And I don't think it was those of us who said this is something we can't, whether we voted or not, right? No matter what we checked when we were inside the voting booth, those of us who said we can't stand with you. We will not be complicit in this action. I think we were right to say that. We have been right to say that. They've been wrong. They need to acknowledge that they were wrong and act to fix their mistakes. Or it's going to be very hard to build any sort of coherence on the left. Like, I think, Gaza's a line. And that's going to structure any sort of left coalition building now and into the future. And if people don't like that, tough, right? Then they need to, then they shouldn't have been complicit in genocide. So in terms of the American context, yeah, I think the center left got really comfortable with being where they were and thought that they didn't have to rely on anyone else, and they were deeply wrong and ignorant and thoughtless and careless and racist, and I can't say enough bad things about their choice to sabotage what at this point was like the closest thing we've ever had to a climate coalition in the United States, right? But that's important to understand why that happened in the nationalist basis for a lot of this market craft stuff, right? And we need to be critical about that. And that includes people who adhere to that strategy. And we've seen some of that. Some people have acted, according to their principles, even when it put them on the outs with the Biden administration and with the center left, but not enough. And that coalition is going to be really, really hard to build if we can't rely on those folks. And we saw that even just in these big hands-off protests the last couple of days, where the question of the genocide was marginalized by organizers, not by participants. I was out here in Philadelphia, and we were chanting for Gaza, and people had signs about freeing Mahmoud Khalil and peace signs, and we had a whole peace contingent. But the groups, the Democratic Party groups that organize these actions and has been taking the leadership to organize these actions, is once again failing on this question. And until they get their mind right, we're going to have a real tough time building amicably, I think, in the United States on the left. And we might have to come at it from another direction.
Yeah, it does bring me back to that thought of a paucity of internationalism, and that being a pretty stark dividing line, I think, certainly these days. But I think that's been a hallmark of left activism in the United States is until we were able to kind of reconcile that, it's a real difficulty to build coalitions across these boundaries.
Yeah, and then you have a hard time convincing anyone on the real left that then their job isn't to destabilize the United States, right? That the most helpful thing they can do is reduce the influence of the United States in world affairs. If you can't get any sort of control or any sort of place in the administration of that state, then you look at the situation and say, well, then America is not the vehicle for progress in the world, and we got to figure out other vehicles. And if there are national market craft people on the left who want to argue with their position, it is on them to show that they are capable of building that coalition and putting these questions first above their commitment to the Zionist state.
Well, Malcolm, we're running out of time here, but just to finish up, I was wondering kind of what you hope readers gain from this book and what you hope to see from the left on the planetary crisis and what is, you know, I think we can agree, an increasingly bleak political landscape.
Yeah, it's tough out here. And I didn't write the book sort of assuming that we were going to be in a better or worse position than we are now. This is sort of how things are going. And that's how I expect them to be going. So I'd like to see some real like critical thinking, like working through some of these contradictions, saying them out loud, some willingness to learn, all around, especially from some of the people, who've had their taste of power, and found that they couldn't get everything they wanted to get done and, you know, are going back to the drawing board a little bit. So I'd like to see more coherence on the left, right? I'd like to see us actually invested in knowing at a deep level, in good faith, what each other are up to and how we can relate to what each other are up to and how we can build a movement out of that without having to come together and do things that people don't believe in. What that leadership looks like, I don't know yet, but I've got some ideas maybe a little bit at the end. There's, I hope, a little further than most stuff people have heard on this question. Whether the like disaster council concept works out or not, I don't know. But I think the left has an opening in this moment to exercise leadership without getting elected and without raising a ton of money, just by like preparing for the actual facts on the ground.
Well, the book is What's Left, Three Paths Through the Planetary Crisis by Malcolm Harris, who's been kind enough to join me today. This is a great conversation. Really appreciate it. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was my conversation with Malcolm Harris, author of the new book, What's Left, Three Paths Through the Planetary Crisis, which is now available in bookstores and perhaps at your local library. It is, in fact, among the new books here at the Champaign Public Library and the Urbana Free Library. So support our libraries here in Champaign-Urbana and go check it out if you feel so moved. And if you're listening from elsewhere, remember that you can support both the author and your local library by asking them if they can order this book and put it on the shelves. So I did quite enjoy my reading of this book, and I do think it's worthwhile to have our socialist thinkers focusing on these big picture questions. I think these days, especially, a book establishing a taxonomy for different left-wing strategies to confront climate and ecological crisis can seem pretty abstract, you know, at a moment when the right-wing fascist presidential administration is dismantling federal agencies and illegally deporting U.S. residents and silencing left-wing activists. There are no doubt immediate pressing concerns that those of us who engage in left-wing activism must attend to, but ultimately, the terrain that we're navigating, the literal and figurative terrain, is shaped by climate change, by ecological crisis. And it must factor into our short-term thinking, our medium-term thinking, and certainly our long-term thinking. You know, if we want to build a new world, we do need to consider the world itself. And in that regard, I think this book certainly gives us some ideas to chew on. So that's today's show. As always, thank you so much for listening to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM, community radio from Champaign, Illinois. The recording of this episode will be online later this evening. Up next on WEFT, we'll put on a song or two up until the top of the hour, and then it's On the Move with Herbert Burnett. Next episode of The Rift will be on Sunday, May 4th, and until then, stay safe out there.
said it's a lock in here until he says so. A little bump from a car key, sit back, darling. It's all about us. Forget the losers, forget the morning. Put a tune on and put your feet up. It's my idea, I hope you know that. We're gonna have this. I'm the one now. Run the red light. It's the bar take, not the door split. A few weeks and I can work it. Keep it simple, keep the same crowd. We're on the inside. I'm the one now. I'm the one now.
Champaign, 90.1 FM, your community radio station since 1981.